First thing they'll notice if they go on our website is that last year we reached 76 million homes. Mm-hmm. And that'll just bless them, I think.
Absolutely.
Agency.org.
Well, I know that they're going to be blessed when they read, yes, indeed, The Purple Pig. And Other Miracles, How Radical Young Intercessors Have Tapped Into the Supernatural and Are Shaking the World and Inspiring Today's Global Prayer Movements. Your gift of $14 or more to Save America Ministries. We'll put it in your hands. A big thank you to Dick Eastman for joining us today. What a blessing this man is. And you can thank the Lord for him and so many others that have stepped out by faith to do the Master's will for such a time as this. Get the book on our website, saveus.org, and you'll be encouraged. And can I urge you to become a partner with us? Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries. P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. God bless you, and let's step out into the gap.
Listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismeyer. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, we had hoped that they were going to be the views of Jonathan Gray for the next hour, but we haven't been able to reach him. Jonathan Gray, of course, from New Zealand, we've had some wonderful programs with him. The last program we did was a two-hour coverage of the history of the world from the time of the Noah's Flood up until the time of Christ's birth, and going into the very secret societies and mystery religions and their influence on the thought of the people during that time. And we'd hope to be able to, of course, pick this story up and bring it up to the present time. However, I'm afraid that Jonathan is not available, so I'm just going to, do a dissertation and hope that you will call in. It's going to be open lines. We've got Jonathan Gray on the line. Oh, that's great. Hi, Jonathan. How are you?
Hello, Dr. Stan. Very well, thank you.
I almost had an apoplectic shock. You know, I was afraid you weren't going to be here, and I was going to be doing a two-hour monologue. So I'm so glad you could be with us.
Yes.
And last time we talked, why, of course, you did. We talked really about the history of the world, beginning with the Noah's Flood and then taking it on up to the time of the birth of Christ and the secret societies, the mystery religions, the forces, the secret forces which really shaped the world during that time. I think, of course, as a prologue to getting to these secret forces that shaped the world in which we live today. So, do you want to pick up there? I notice you have a new book out on the secret knowledge. I was intrigued. I tried to get a copy of it before the program, but that sounds like another fascinating subject for discussion, because there really is secret knowledge. There are secrets out there that are unknown to the average individual, and I'm sure that your thoughts on this would be a very, very parallel to mine. But can we sort of pick up the story? Now, you know, the evolution of history from, say, from the time of Christ on up until the present time.
Yes, I'd be very happy to do that, Dr. Stan. And perhaps just a little bit of reviewing from last time may help put us all back into the picture again before we move on further.
You go right ahead.
Okay. We go back to the time of the Tower of Babel. when a group of people left their original landing spot where the ark had landed, and they moved through the mountains to a great plain, and there they decided that they would be far enough away from Mr. Noah that they wouldn't hear his preaching any longer, and they would set up their own way of life. And we know the story of the Tower of Babel and how God confused the language and how Nimrod ultimately was executed for his idolatry. We did cover that.
Yes,
and how
we did.
His widow, Queen Semiramis, in shock, was not to be beaten, however, to retain her power and that of the priest that had been working with Nimrod. She offered herself to them in exchange for them perpetuating the story that Nimrod was the promised savior who had been promised way back in Eden, and that he was the one who had benefited the people. Enemies had wrongly murdered him, but that and his spirit had gone to the sun. But that a beam from the sun had impregnated her womb, and she was the promised virgin mother, and that her son would be Nimrod, reincarnated as her, or resurrected as the one who would ultimately rule and defeat his enemies. And that was the beginning of the sacred mystery.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and you go right ahead and pick this up from there, because, of course, there was always this secret power that was always available. And, of course, this, when we look at the Statue of Liberty, what does the Statue of Liberty represent? Well, some people think that it represents Semiramis, and others, of course, think that it was Diana. But certainly the Statue of Liberty, at least as far as the occultist who put it up, and remember, of course, that it was a Mason who designed the Statue of Liberty. It was a Mason who actually then put out the architectural design for it. It was a Mason who built the pedestal there in New York Harbor on which it rests. They raised the funds for it. The Statue of Liberty, which represents certainly a pagan goddess, having nothing to do with the liberty of America, it's symbolic to those of us in America as a symbol of liberty, but not to the people who designed it and put it up, because it represented the ancient mysteries and these ancient fables. But go right ahead.
Yeah, these mysteries, of course, spread worldwide, and you mentioned a couple of names there, Dr. Stan. Well, these names were used by the pagans depending upon their language, and all the way across the world on all continents, the mystery religion of Babel was dispersed by the scattering of the people, and they took this false religion with them, which was really, contained in some of its elements, a corruption of the original prophecy given to mankind that a savior was coming. And they mythologized this savior in the person of Nimrod, and eventually lost sight of that part of it, but it kept on worshipping a goddess and her husband and her child as a pagan triune group. And it was a counterfeit of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ and his promised coming. However, there were still people among the nations who believed that the Messiah was yet to come. And these people actually were in harmony with what the scriptures revealed relating to the coming one. We have 300 prophecies in the Old Testament relating to the coming Savior, which were fulfilled, of course, in Yeshua, the Jesus Christ coming to earth. And we must bear in mind that this is not just a human development. What we have here is a battle, a war, a very fierce war to the end between Lucifer, who was cast out of heaven, and the Prince of God.
Hold that thought. Well, Dr. Stan, and Jonathan makes the point, of course, that Nimrod was executed for his heresies. And, of course, he wanted to be as a god, and they built an incomplete Tower of Babylon. You can actually go to Strasbourg today, where the European Parliament meets. They've actually reconstructed the incomplete Tower of Babylon. Why would you build a building as if it were incomplete? Because they understand, the European Parliament, people interested in bringing about a world government, understand the symbolism of what's going on today with the European Union, the United Nations. The average individual doesn't, but of course Jonathan makes the point that it was Nimrod's wife, and I can never remember, I always called Semiramis, but Semiramis is another name, that's another pronunciation. And then, of course, she had a son, and so that there was sort of a trinity, an unholy trinity of Nimrod, who was dead, and then, of course, the wife and the son. And it was basically a dark counterpart of the holy trinity, which was becoming. But Jonathan makes the point that there were literally 300 prophecies about the coming of Christ, and they were searching all through the Old Testament, of course, prophesying that the Messiah would come. But there was also the satanic forces in the world, of course, these people who worshiped Lucifer, who hated the idea that, of course, that God would one day come to rule the world. But you pick the story up, please, Jonathan, from there.
Thank you. Well, in particular, I think the most marvelous messianic prophecy was that of Daniel. The angel Gabriel came to Daniel, and he revealed to Daniel. In fact, Daniel was a captive in Babylon. The nation of Judah had been swept into Babylon, and many of them, of course, fled elsewhere around the world, and Jewish influence became quite a thing. In many countries as far away as China and Japan. And meanwhile, Daniel's prophecy was given. Daniel was praying in Babylon. He was reading the book of Jeremiah. And Jeremiah had stated that because the nation had rejected the prophets of God, that they would be dispossessed of their land for 70 years. And the intention was that they would learn a lesson. They themselves had drifted into Babylonian idolatry, following the heathen nations around them. They worshipped God with heathen practices. And, of course, this is an abomination, and they had to be cured of it. And God is very, very merciful. He actually let them go into Babylon, which was the center of paganism, so that they would become so thoroughly sick up to their ears with the paganism around them that they would give it away forever, and they would never again go into pagan idolatry. And that was the reason for them going into captivity. And as it turned out, when they did get back to Jerusalem eventually, as they were very, very strict, they went the opposite extreme, idolatry was no longer the problem. However, Daniel, reading the prophet Jeremiah, that there would be 70 years accomplished in the exile, realized the time was getting close. And so he offered a prayer of reconciliation to God and confessing the sins of the nation and himself, and asking the Lord not to delay, not to defer the restoration. And then the angel Gabriel came to explain the prophecy, which is known as the 70-week prophecy, a prophecy that dealt with two subjects, one, Jerusalem, and two, the Messiah. And in that prophecy, an actual time frame was given from the date when the command would go to rebuild and to restore and to build Jerusalem till Messiah the Prince would appear. And it was spelled out so accurately, so precisely, that there was no doubt when the time would be near. And now, Daniel's prophecies, because Jews had been scattered everywhere, and the Jewish people were in communication with each other among the different countries, it wasn't long before Daniel's prophecies went everywhere. And we have evidence that in the reign of Darius Hystaspes, king of Persia, the Persians, of course, took over from Babylon when they conquered it, but Daniel survived as a very honoured person in the regime set up by the Persians. And in the reign of that king, Darius Hystaspes, the mystic Zoroaster served under Daniel. And I think we did touch on that, didn't we, Pastor Stan?
No, we really didn't.
Okay, well, perhaps it'd be of interest to our listeners to go into this. I think it's fascinating to me anyway. Zoroaster was well-versed in the sacred writings of the Jews. And when he saw the great, good, and wise Daniel attain such a height and dignity in the empire, Zoroaster craftily set out to adopt many features of Daniel's religion, even copying some of Daniel's visions, would you believe? And he's also believed to have conferred with Jeremiah. There are some records which do suggest this. And Jeremiah, of course, was the one we mentioned earlier who had predicted the exile. And it turns out that a number of doctrines from Daniel do reappear in the teachings of this man, Zoroaster. I'll just list a few. The one supreme God, the coming of the Messiah, the existence of angels, the fact that angels are communicators between God and man frequently, and he also adopted the teaching of the final resurrection of the dead and the judgment of all mankind. Now, that's absolutely remarkable, because here we have a sun worshipper adopting many Hebrew and biblical teachings. Now, he actually wrote a book called The Book of Abraham, and in that he placed some of the same observances about meat, clean and unclean, that were given to Moses 900 years before. And there were commands on the payment of tithes, on the ordaining of one high priest over all, and even in Zoroaster's writings there were references to Joseph, Moses, and Solomon in exactly the same way that they're presented in the Hebrew Bible. And like the Hebrews, although he was a sun worshipper, Zoroaster hated idol worship. So these concepts were all mixed up with his sun god Mithra and his fire worship. I find that rather fascinating.
Well, now, didn't he actually talk about this battle between good and evil, between light and darkness, between God and Satan?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. That's right. And in the prophets, God, in the Old Testament, God reveals to these pagans that he is the one who has created everything, whether it be the forces of light or darkness. That when you withdraw light, darkness comes, of course, but God is the creator of light, and darkness is the absence of light. Zoroaster understood that, but he got it from the Bible.
And I think it's really so interesting. People point out, well, my goodness, you know, here you are 600 years before Christ is born, and you've already got all these stories. They're all there beforehand. I mean, Christianity was simply duplicating Zoroastrianism. Of course, Zoroastrianism was simply, duplicating the prophecies that prophesied the coming of the true Messiah.
Yes, that is so interesting. People today, I notice that on the internet, Dr. Stan, there are people today who are saying that Christianity is a copycat of the old pagan mystery Christ. Well, it's the other way around. They ought to really get to know their history, because the truth of history is that there was a promise of the coming Messiah from the very first beginning. And that after Babel, this prophecy was counterfeited or copycatted by the pagans, but it was a prophecy that was still going to come true in the person of Jesus Christ ultimately. The pagan Christ are only myths. There's no historical basis for any of them. You can't pin any time in history for any one of those Christs. There's only one actually who pinpoints in history, and as a matter of fact, not only is he in history, but he cut history into two sections, before and after his name. And he's the only one that emblazoned his name on the calendars of the world, B.C. and A.D.
Yeah, it really is so amazing, and yet, of course, everything is done today to degrade and deride Christianity, and yet certainly it was his life, his death, and his resurrection that marked the beginning of modern-day civilization. But go right ahead.
Yes. Now, it's interesting, Dr. Stan, that the religion of Zoroaster that he began to teach, although it's anti-Christian, it soon began to tell of Mithra. Mithra was the sun god. Mithra, the mediator between God and man, and of his visit to earth to defend the faithful, of his ascension to heaven, of the baptism that he instituted, of his second coming, and finally the restoration of all things and the unending reign of the righteous, just as the Bible does. Now, that is absolutely astonishing. But this act started because of the influence of Daniel. And he admired Daniel, and he thought, I'd better bring into my religion a lot of these elements because it'll help my religion to be successful. And that's exactly what happened for quite a few hundred years. For about 600 years, Mithraism was to become the dominant culture of the Persians and the Parthian empires, and later one was adopted by Rome.
And of course, here you had your magi, you had all these people who were involved with the mystery religions, and they were all tied into Zoroastrianism, and of course they were tapped into, I think, the secret knowledge. There has always been this secret knowledge out there, but it comes not from God, but from the dark side. And so basically, remember the three, I don't have to tell you, but the three magi came. They were simply magicians tied into this, but they knew the prophecies, they knew the writings, they knew Christ was going to come, and they wanted to come to see the Christ child. People don't understand the relationship between so much of what we read in the Bible and the ancient mystery religions. Well, pick the story up from there, please, Jonathan.
Yes. Well, it was not only in Persia that Jewish influence spread into other religions. Jews, as I mentioned a little while back, they traveled in numerous caravans to other places such as India, Tibet, and even China. And this had the effect of disseminating the biblical books and teachings and the prophecies of the coming Messiah among all the inhabitants of Asia. And I guess there was a divine providence in that. In fact, it's not easy to find any spot on earth where the Jews had not settled. And in the 5th century BC, or rather, should we pinpoint this around about 595 BC to about 574 BC, Ezekiel gives a wonderful account of the caravan traffic with Tyre in his day. Now, Tyre, of course, was one of the city-states on the Mediterranean Sea next to modern-day Israel, occupying an area in southern Lebanon. And the people of Tyre, of course, were very, very adventurous. Their ships went all over the world. We've actually had traces of them coming all the way down to Australia and New Zealand too, and to the Americas.
Well, now, were they already sort of concomitant with the Phoenicians, what we refer to as the Phoenicians?
Phoenicians, that's correct, yes. Okay. Tyre, Sidon, and their colony in North Africa, Carthage, and many other spots. Venice, the word Venice in Italy comes from Phoenice. That was a Phoenician colony that was established. So they also went to England, Britain, up into the northern the Baltic states. They travelled the world. They went across through Indonesia, up into China. They circumnavigated Africa. The Phoenicians were planted, I do believe, right next to the land of the promised land of Canaan, because while the nation of Israel was given the gospel of the coming one, the ships of Phoenicia could carry it around the world, and that would have been perfect. We find this happening in the days of Solomon. If that had continued, it would have been great, but of course they went into apostasy and idolatry. But nevertheless, the Phoenicians did carry quite a bit of the news of the coming one where they went. And Ezekiel describes the caravan traffic with Tyre, which was similar to that of Confucius and Laozi and Gautama Buddha and Pythagoras. And astonishing and significant as we might consider this, within 100 years after the death of Daniel, the different religions, Zoroastrianism began to flourish in Persia, Buddhism sprang up in India, and Confucianism in China, and all of them had borrowed certain elements from the Hebrew Scriptures. Now, this is a period immediately after Daniel's prophecies began sowing the world with these electrifying conceptions about God. Now, as for the Jews themselves in exile, they were aroused to a pitch of enthusiasm by the prophecies of Daniel. Because, look, after all, Daniel had said that the coming of the Messiah was to come at a certain time and he was to be a suffering mediator who would pay the death penalty for man's wrong. And that was an electrifying thought. He actually enlarged on the earlier prophecy.
All that thought, and Chris, Jonathan's just saying that the exciting things about Daniel's prophecies were, of course, this Messiah was going to come, and he was going to pay the debt for man's sin, for man's wrongs. And of course, the Daniel's prophecies really became the ideas that permeated all the existing religions at that time. Buddhism, Hinduism, all of the ancient religions had at least some of these ideas put forward by Daniel the prophet about the coming of the Jewish Messiah. So please pick up the story.
Yes. It's interesting also, Dr. Stan, that Daniel's famous visions that were taken up by Zoroaster, there's evidence that in turn there was close communication between Persia and India, which brought the Zoroastrianism to the Hindu people. And it's known now that Buddha, Gautama Buddha, as he's known, and also the Hindus, knew of this coming. And the Buddhist reform that was made later was based on the doctrines that Zoroaster brought to them. Now, until the time of Buddha, about 500 BC, now 500 BC is roughly around the time when Daniel would have been dying. Daniel lived right almost up to that time. India had been in the grip of what they called Brahmanism. But Buddhism changed the idolatry of Brahmanism, worship of millions of gods, to the worship of Buddha himself, one God. And its teaching is terminated with ceremonies and teachings which imitate the earlier religion of the Old Testament, even though it's steeped in a lot of paganism. We can see the traces that sort of came in and gave a little bit of a window here and there of truth. Now, we might then ask, did Buddha know about Daniel's prophecy that gave the time of the Messiah's appearance? Well, from my research, it does appear so. About 500 years, this is what Buddha said. He said, about 500 years after my death, a prophet will arise who will found his teaching on the great fathers. And when that one comes, believe in him and you'll receive incalculable blessings. So he was pinpointing the time of Jesus Christ and saying that a great one was going to come who had been known to all the ancient fathers. We can only look at Jesus Christ as being a fulfillment of that. Now, the same wave of influence continued into China. We noted that the Israelites did find their way to China, and as a matter of fact, it's notable that many of them were employed in important military posts in China, and some of them even became ministers of state, even provincial governors and professors in China. And there seems to be evidence that Confucius understood and profited from the great reformation that had taken place in Judaism when they dropped off all their idols because of the captivity. And so he introduced his new code of ethics from Judaism, and that was the teaching of one God, which the Bible had taught for centuries. And the Chinese people took to that one quite well, actually. It won favor. And Confucius also made a statement. He said, a saint will be born in the West, and he will restore the lost knowledge. So there was a little whisper of the coming one, the coming savior. And it's interesting that Roman historians of the first century also bear witness to a worldwide expectation of a coming Messiah. I could mention perhaps in particular Tacitus and another one. Tacitus is probably the greatest Roman historian ever, that ever lived. And he speaks of the expectation of a Messiah. He also speaks of Jesus Christ after he was born and of his trial and execution and of the group of Christians that arose. And then there was Suetonius who spoke of the expectation of a coming Messiah. And it's interesting that the Romans believed that this Messiah would be born in Judea. Now, why would the Romans expect that? And it was also known among many Gentile nations that it was to be the land of Judea where the great Lord of the earth was to come. And this perhaps may have given an inkling to the wise men who followed the star that there was more to it than we realized. There was an expectation worldwide that a great one was coming about that time, and also that he'd be born in Judea. And around this time, we of course know, Jesus Christ appeared and Christianity began to spread worldwide. All of this information given to the Hebrew prophets, and particularly to Daniel, did help to pave the way for the coming one. So the Lord did his best to reach people long before Jesus arrived.
And that's really what's so exciting about the study of history, is you begin to see how it all fits together. But so much of this is never taught. They never tell you why the wise men came. Jonathan, you go right ahead.
Okay. All right. Now, Christianity revealed itself all over the world very soon after after Jesus came. And as a matter of fact, we have Paul writing in one of his letters that the gospel had been preached to all creatures under the earth. It's very, very interesting, actually, that I've been able to uncover records of the knowledge of the gospel coming not only to North America and South America very soon after it went to Europe and Africa and Asia, but even into the Pacific Ocean. The Tahitian people, when missionaries arrived in Tahiti less than 200 years ago, they found that the Tahitian people had kept a record right down through their ancestry of an event that happened about 2,000 years earlier. And that was that great ships had come from the west. There were two tribes that were in a deadly combat on the main island of Tahiti at the time, and they looked out and here was this great sailing ship with its great white sails. And from there came men who landed on the shore. As a matter of fact, both tribes were fighting. Suddenly the war stopped, the fighting stopped, because both of them were mesmerized by this unusual sight. It was just like a UFO landing in their midst. Here was unknown strangers coming from the west in a great ship. They came in a little boat, smaller boat to the land, and then they started telling these natives of the great Son of God who had died and who had risen again, and that all men were equal. All men and women were now equal, and they must stop fighting. And so they did. And this is in Tahitian legend going back 2,000 years.
It's really amazing as you see all of this. But then, of course, there was all the forces that were at work. Certainly Christianity was here, but the occult influence was here, permeated every aspect of the world. But people were looking desperately for a solution to the problems and the violence and all of the things that were going on in the world. And here was a story of promise of a better life to come.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Stan, I guess Jonathan Edwards is simply pointing out that there was a story, certainly the story of Christianity, had spread far throughout the world. He gives many examples of that. You know, certainly hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years before, we anticipate that certainly the story was spread, and even into Tahiti, where their records tell about the great ships coming, meeting people, telling the Tahitian natives about the Son of God and why they should stop fighting. And it transformed much of what happened in Tahiti after this. This was several hundred years ago. But go ahead with the story, Jonathan.
Well, Christianity, of course, was revealing itself in many nations, and it became a conquering force upon the hearts and the minds of many people. And let's go to India, for example. Now, India was under the grip of Hinduism and Buddhism, and although they had a small window of expectation and knowledge, they didn't really know Jesus Christ at all. But when Christianity began to spread and say that he had already come, and that he was the saviour of everyone who would accept him, year after year, decade after decade, it had amazing success in India. And the story of the birth of Jesus coming in human flesh was winning hearts everywhere. Now, when Christianity was introduced into India in the first century, and Thomas actually is credited as being the one who landed there, and one of the other disciples in the year 52 AD. Travel was frequent and easy. In fact, we have a record that 120 great ships sailed for India from Egypt every year. Now, that's about 2 to 3 ships a week were sailing from the Bible region across to India weekly. That's not bad. And so there was a lot of travel going on, apart from the overland travel. And in the succeeding centuries, numerous Christians poured into India from Persia and from Mesopotamia. And a detailed history actually exists today of Christianity in the East. It's been well preserved by the Persians and the Syrians. And these were people who were writing in the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries, describing the spread of Christianity. And all over the land, an increasing number of strong Christians began to rise up. And I'm focusing here on India for a moment. It's interesting that Marco Polo, the great Italian explorer, would later testify that in his time there were 6 great kings and kingdoms in the heart of India, and 3 of those were Christian. The other 3 were Mohammedan, Muslim. So a transformation had taken place by the time of Marco Polo, and Marco Polo reported that the greatest of all the 6 kingdoms in India was a Christian one. So the news coming to India concerning Jesus was by no means a trivial incursion. Now, you can imagine how the Hindus and the Buddhists would look upon this. The news coming was big news. And by 600 AD, the Brahmins woke up with a start. And they realized that these new truths were snatching their power from them. And they figured out that they'd better come forward and put an end to this crisis once and for all. So they did something. It was like another Semiramis counterfeit, a big-sized one. They realized they needed to accomplish 3 things. First, they must invent a god of their own that entered a human body. Second, they must give this counterfeit Christ a name similar to Christ, with similar events in his life and similar teachings. And thirdly, they must arrange their chronology to coincide with Hindu astronomy, to throw the date of this fabricated god back about 600 years before the time of Jesus Christ, so that they could claim precedence over the Christian religion. Now, since they already had thousands of existing gods, it would not be too difficult to find one whose name sounded a little bit like Christ. And the deity they settled upon from among their supply of gods that they already worshipped was the god Krishna. And having made the selection, they then drew up a special body of literature to teach this new ideas and to push it back 600 years into the past. And for a long time, this fraud succeeded. And I noticed there are still people on the internet who think that Christ has come from the Hindu Krishna. It's just a copycat of the Hindu Krishna. Well, the fraud was detected after about 1200 years, around about 1800. The similarity between Krishna and Christ was long noticed, and Indian priests were claiming that Krishna's incarnation was before Christ, and they loved to boast that the New Testament was fabricated from Hindu epics. And then in 1825, a sharp-minded researcher by the name of John Bentley solved the mystery. And from the Hindu Brahmins, he obtained knowledge and information that this had just been an invention. And today, Bentley's findings are pretty solidly set, that Krishna was chosen from among all the Hindu gods because of its sounding close to the name of Christ. But of course, that's not a good argument, because the name Krishna means all attractive. But on the other hand, the word Christ comes from the Greek word Christos, which means anointed, which is derived from a word krio, which means to smear or rub from oil, by implication, to anoint. And this is simply a translation of the Hebrew Mashiach, anointed, which refers to a consecrated person, specifically the Messiah. So the similarity is very superficial, and of all the 600,000 gods of Hinduism, only this one Krishna shows a little similarity to the English word Christ, but make no mistake, the two names have different origins.
Well, anything to undermine or certainly challenge the Christian claims, go right ahead.
And of course, the name Mashiach was used in the biblical book of Daniel as early as the 6th century BC to denote the coming of the Messiah. And since the New Testament record of Jesus Christ was published in the universally understood common Greek language of the 1st century, I mean, Greek was a bit like English is today. Although people have their own native languages, they also largely speak English all over the world too. And Greek had that honour in the days of Christ. And so the New Testament ultimately was written in Greek, and the purpose was to reach all nations. And so the Greek word equivalent to Mashiach, meaning anointed, it was inevitable that the Greek, Christ, meaning anointed, would be used. So Mashiach in Hebrew became Christ in Greek, and the two mean exactly the same. So the name Christ was not borrowed from the Hindu Krishna at all. It was a direct translation from the Hebrew used by Daniel as early as the 6th century BC in the Old Testament. But if we wanted to probe, and perhaps it wouldn't hurt to do that for a moment, if we wanted to probe the origin of this Krishna god that the Hindus had, it goes all the way back to Queen Semiramis of Babel, no less. The Krishna legend is simply an Indian version of the Nimrod story. And it's interesting that Nimrod, descended from Ham, was Negroid in appearance, and the infant Krishna in the arms of Devaki is Negro-featured likewise. He's a black god in the Hindu pantheon. And the identity of Krishna certainly goes back to Nimrod, has nothing to do with Jesus Christ. All right. And the charge that Jesus' crucifixion was borrowed from the Hindu god that was crucified is also a lot of nonsense. I mean, I mention this only, Pastor Stan, because we read this on the internet. There are people putting out these stupid ideas on the internet and hoping a gullible public will swallow them. The fact is, there's no crucified Indian god ever in any Indian mythology. It's a total fabrication by some modern person writing in English on the internet.
In fact, crucifixion really didn't come around until about that time in Roman history, did it? It wasn't a method of execution.
That is true, yeah. It was actually a Roman invention. Okay, well, I just thought that would be of interest, to how the relationship between the pagan knowledge of Christ and the truth of Jesus Christ.
Well, it is fascinating, and there's so much there that really we don't learn, and this is one of the big problems. Most Christians don't understand the history, certainly the history of the other religions as they relate to the true religion, which is Christianity. But go right ahead.
Okay, now we have some interesting developments when Christianity began to spread around the world. And let's go back to the Middle East now, to the Bible land. When we look at what was happening in the early days of Christianity, it was a threat to two religions, and that was the religion of the rabbis, the Jewish Sanhedrin, who rejected him, it was a threat to the paganism, which worshipped Lucifer direct. Perhaps it would be of interest to look at the development of Christianity within the Jewish community, because I think this is really crucial, and a lot of our dear Jewish friends, I think, would be very surprised to know this kind of history being kept from the people normally. Now, we've got a development taking place in the early centuries, or in the first century, and it leads to a big hoax that was perpetrated upon Judaism after Christianity began to spread. And the ordinary people today are generally unaware of it. Sadly, the history of early Judaism has been misrepresented to the Jewish people by standard Jewish literature and, or we could say, by their rabbis. Now, although most rabbinic literature has mischaracterized first century Judaism as being almost totally Pharisaical, the truth is that the religious situation in the first century was one of great flux. There were actually six or seven different groups struggling for ascendancy within the Israeli Jewish community. And most of these were represented on the Sanhedrin, the council. Now, the representation initially did include also the so-called Nazarenes, or those who believed in Yeshua of Nazareth. Then came the Roman siege of Jerusalem in AD 70. And we know the prophecy that Jesus gave in Matthew 24. He told them this was going to come, and he said, get out when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies. You get out. Run for your lives quickly. You won't have much time to go down to your house and pick up your goods. Just go. And I always find this fascinating, a wonderful prophecy, because it was given about 40 years before the event, and 35 years rather before the event in AD 26, there was a siege of Jerusalem. There had been a revolt against something that one of the Roman leaders had done. The Roman army came down from Syria. They surrounded Jerusalem, just as Jesus predicted. But then for some unknown reason, they withdrew. Now, you can't flee when you're surrounded. And Jesus knew that. He gave the prophecy, he said, when you see Jerusalem surrounded, then get out of the city. Well, how could they? Well, we're told by history that for some unknown reason, Cestius's troops withdrew when they just about had Jerusalem in a stranglehold. They withdrew for no apparent reason, according to the historians. And the Christians saw their opportunity, because they had been told to look for this opportunity, and not one Christian escaped. And you can look at the Encyclopedia Judaica, Jewish Encyclopedia, and it admits that the whole Christian population of Jerusalem escaped safely across the Jordan River to Pella. Now, at the same time as the Christians were running out of Jerusalem because they believed Jesus' prophecy, thousands of other Jews were swarming into Jerusalem, because now it was war between the Jews and the Romans. And the Roman occupation came back soon, and the Jews that had flooded into Jerusalem were now trapped. They couldn't get out. In fact, they didn't want to get out. They thought behind the walls of Jerusalem they'd be safe. That's why they went there. And that went on for 3 or 4 years until the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And while no Christian lost their lives because they had accepted the prophecies of Yeshua, virtually no one escaped who had been in that city. They were either slaughtered or sold into slavery. And I think it was something like 1.1 million people died in that siege of Jerusalem. How sad.
It was. It's a great, great tragedy. This has been a recurrent, really, down through the ages, these mass numbers of people being slaughtered. We find it difficult to believe and understand that some of the things we're seeing today are simply a replay of what's happened time and time and time again throughout history. So the Christians were able to escape from Jerusalem. We know that John and Mary apparently went up to Ephesus, somewhere along in that area. At least that's as the story is told. But go right ahead.
Yes. You know, about the only person who got away, the lead Pharisee, Rabbi Jochanan ben Zakkai, was able to fake his own death, and he was removed alive from the city during the siege, and he was able to reorganize the Sanhedrin at a place called Yavne, on strictly Pharisaical ground. Now, about 20 years later, AD 90, his successor, Rabbi Gamaliel II, in order to drive the Nazarenes out of the synagogue, because they were numbering about 20,000 to 25,000 Christians were worshipping in the synagogues in that region. And to drive them out, he added what became known as a curse against the Menon, Menon meaning heretics. And this was added to the 18 benedictions that were recited at every authorized synagogue. Yet despite this, it seemed impossible to curb the growth of the Christian movement. We go forward another 40 years into the 130 after Christ, 130s AD. And this was the boldest move of all, to get rid of Jesus Christ and to destroy the growth of the Christian movement. Rabbi Akivah, who's known as the father of the Mishnah, he attempted to answer the Christians by promoting a non-Septuagint translation of the Hebrew Scriptures into Greek. And when this was read, it was found that he had ripped out key words in the Messianic text that were specially used by the Christians to demonstrate Jesus as Messiah. Imagine that. No Jew had previously mutilated the Scriptures at all because they considered it God's Word. But here's a rabbi, Rabbi Akivah, who actually tore out key words in the Messianic text.
Well, that thought will be right back. Could not use them. Go right ahead. We've got 3 minutes.
Not hear them being taught.
We've got 3 minutes for this segment of the program, so you go ahead and then we'll take over and then we'll come back right after the beginning of the next hour. But go right ahead. We have about 2.5 minutes now.
Okay. Well, this boy was pretty thorough. Akivah chopped out not only some of the text out of the Old Testament to minimize the Messianic evidence, but then he went to the calendar. And he chopped out at least 160 years of known Persian history. And why did he do that? Because the prophecy of Daniel chapter 9 had given 490 years prophesied, during which Messiah must appear. And by chopping out 160 years of history, that would mean that the 490-year prophecy was not completed in the time of Jesus Christ, but it would reach into the second century, into their own day. And then about 4 or 5 years later, around about 140 AD, Rabbi Yossi ben Halafta, and he was one of Akivah's main disciples, he codified and mutilated Jewish chronology in his book, which he called the Seder Olam Rabbah, Book of the Order of the World. Now, this book cuts out about 60 years between Adam and the birth of Abraham. It cuts out another 17 years between Solomon and the consecration of the Second Temple in 515 BC. But it cuts out a whopping 164 years of Persian history between 515 and 70 AD. Now, the true history of Persia goes on for much longer than that. The true history of Persia was, it lasted from 538 BC, when the Persians took Babylon, down to 331 BC, when Alexander the Great, the Greek, defeated Persia. So there's 184 years of Persian history. But the falsified history reduced the 184 years down to 24 years. Now, that's what this Jewish rabbi did.
Well, I'm sure anything appears to undermine Christianity, because I'm sure that they must have recognized, even reading some of the prophecies, like Isaiah 53, that obviously the Christian faith was real, and yet, of course, it undermined their power and their control over the Jewish people. And we'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan Gray, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here. Our guest, of course, is Jonathan Gray, and we're going into the history that really every Christian should know, and very, very few Christians are ever taught. And this is why I thought that Jonathan's information is really so fascinating. And he's talking certainly about the how many of the rabbis would actually change the dates and remove parts of history, anything to undermine a belief in Christianity. Because, of course, if Christianity is true, then, of course, the Pharisees and Sadducees' view of the Gospels was wrong. And it was really all about power. I believe there were dark forces working within the Pharisees and Sadducees, dedicated to the destruction of this new religion, this new fulfillment of Jewish prophecy, this religion of Christianity. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported. Now, incidentally, I'm not a pastor. I'm a retired orthopedic surgeon, but I like to look upon what we do as a ministry, because we're trying to get people to understand we're involved in this spiritual battle being fought on a political and ideological and cultural and financial and educational battlefield. But this is a spiritual battle that we're engaged in today. Until we understand that there are powerful spiritual forces behind everything taking place politically, why, nothing really makes sense. So if you are out there in the listening audience and you agree with me, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Remember, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And I've been so fascinated listening to Jonathan, I haven't let him get any information out on his ministry. Jonathan, how could people get in touch with your ministry?
Well, Dr. Stan, they can come, thank you for asking, they can come to www.beforeus.com, BEFORE US.com. And they can also email me. They can join my free newsletter, which I'll send out once a week online. It's all available there on that website, beforeus.com.
And, of course, we carry one of your major books. What's the title of that one?
Dead Man's Secrets.
Dead Man's Secrets. We actually carry that book. But Jonathan has some of the most amazing DVDs. In fact, somebody had sent them to us, and that's how we became acquainted with Jonathan Gray, who, of course, followed the path of Ron Wyatt, who we interviewed before he passed away. And we're fascinated by Ron Wyatt's work and his work with the True Mount Sinai, the Red Sea Crossing, Noah's Ark, the Ark of the Covenant. I mean, fascinating material. And of course, Jonathan has followed on so much of this, the true location of Sodom and Gomorrah. And of course, we've had what Ron and Jonathan said, actually verified by the gentleman who is our producer this evening, who was fortunate enough on a trip to Israel to be taken to the true Sodom and Gomorrah. I've been there to Israel six different times with expensive tours. Never once did they show us the certified locations of Sodom and Gomorrah. But I was fascinated that Sir Jonathan had been there. In fact, he spent a night sleeping in one of those cities that were a little concerned because of the scorpions there. But Jonathan has some of the most wonderful stories and wonderful DVDs, and we recommend his material to you. And certainly we do carry his book, Sydney on Dead Man's Secret. So that's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. You'll be fascinated by his weekly emails, all sorts of information you're not going to get through regular channels, but information that tends to validate the authenticity of the Holy Scriptures. So once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. We encourage you to go there to watch our DVDs, to listen to our radio programs, to read our newsletters, and then, of course, we ask you to pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And we'll be back here in just a moment with the second hour with Jonathan. Well, Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest for the second hour will be Jonathan Gray, if she's good enough to stay with us. And basically, as Jonathan was explaining, all the efforts were made to by the Jewish rabbis, certainly the members of the Pharisees, to undermine the belief in Christianity, because this was challenging their authority and their ability to control the Jewish people. And unfortunately, there is certainly a tendency within religious organizations to want to be in controlling, to control the minds of the people. So Jonathan is simply giving us the background of many of the things that were done to distort the history of that time, removing large segments from history and so much of what we read today in our textbooks, and certainly as we're told by our experts. It just is not true. So you pick up the story of what's happening here. What are we, so the first century A.D.?
Yeah, so we're talking here about the first century into the second century A.D. And we have here the Rabbi Akivah, who's known as the father of the Mishnah, around about in the 130s, just 30 years into the new century, cutting out 160 years of Persian history. So the 490-year prophecy of messianic prophecy of Daniel would bypass Jesus Christ and stretch into the second century. And then a few years later, around AD 40, his accomplice, Rabbi Yose ben Halafta, codified this mutilated Jewish chronology into a book, which is used widely today in the Jewish community. It's called the Book of the Order of the World, or Seder Olam Rabbah. Now, this false history, in true Persian history, there were 10 kings ruling. These kings ruled from 538 down to 331, when Alexander the Great defeated Persia and ended the empire. So we've got 140 years of Persian history there, and 10 kings. The falsified history cuts out 5 of the kings and cuts down the 484 years of Persian history down to 24 years. Absolutely incredible. Slices out 160 years of history. Would you believe, this fake history is now used today worldwide by mainstream modern Jewry, an officially accepted fake. Now, it might be asked why cuts were made in the Persian period rather than in the Greek, the Seleucid area that followed that. Well, the answer is that Akhazar and Yosef ben Halafta couldn't make any cuts from the Greek period because the chronology of that period was still in use. It was still too close to their own day, and people would see through it. It was firmly fixed among the Jews, it was well understood, it was too well known. So the best these poor men could do to pull off their deception was to go back to the earlier period, the Persian Empire period. And, of course, since the prophecy of Daniel 9 dealt with a decree that was issued by a Persian monarch to restore and build Jerusalem, this was the empire that preceded the Greeks. This left only this Persian Empire of history for them to exploit. Well, we might say thank you, honest teachers, but we found you out. It's important to bear in mind that Josephus, their own historian, disagrees with them about the length of the Persian history. So any argument that maybe Josephus had done it is absolutely hollow. Now, the logical question that I guess anyone's going to ask is, do any of today's Jewish scholars know about this deliberate date fiddling? Well, yes, they do. Most certainly they do. The Encyclopedia Judaica has this to say, and I'll quote it, about Rabbi Yossi's compression of the Persian period. Listen to this. I've got this encyclopedia right in front of me. It says the most significant confusion in Rabbi Yossi's calculation is the compression of the Persian period. From the rebuilding of the temple by Zerubbabel in 516 BC.
Hold that thought.
Okay.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Jonathan is simply quoting from the Jewish Encyclopedia, and certainly modern-day Jewish scholars have analyzed, of course, what was done back there in the first century to alter the history of that era. Why? Because, of course, they had to discredit Christianity even then, and so they simply removed about 100, 150 years of time period, because, you see, the prophecies of Daniel were very exact, and from the time that Cyrus was going to give the order for the rebuilding of the temple was to be exactly so many years and so many days, and that would be the time then when the Messiah would come. Well, I mean, certainly, how could you have a prophecy that would be accurate down to the very day? And so they couldn't allow that to stand, and so they just had to remove large periods of history so that they could say, see, it's not true at all, just as in rabbinical schools, I've been told, even today. When they're studying the book of Isaiah, they go from Isaiah 52 to Isaiah 54. Why? Because if you read Isaiah 53, you'll realize that Isaiah was talking about Jesus Christ, the most amazing, really one of the amazing prophecies. But certainly the removal of the time period was meant to discredit the writings of Daniel. So pick the story up there. What does it say in the modern Jewish encyclopedia?
Oh, Dr. Stan, this is what it says. Quote, the most significant confusion in Rabbi Yossi's calculation is the compression of the Persian period. From the rebuilding of the temple by Zerubbabel in 516 BC to the conquest of Persia by Alexander, compressing it to no more than 34 years. Well, there's an admission by the most respected authority in among the Jewish people today. And quite a number of Jewish scholars are aware of this problem, and some, such as Rabbi Simon Schwab, have tried to justify this chronological cover-up by stating something which I can hardly believe that he'd even bothered that he'd dare write. He admits here, and I'm quoting him, that there was purposely eliminated and suppressed all records and other material pertaining to this change of removing years. And he says it was purposely eliminated and it was suppressed and all records pertaining to it. Now, there's a frank admission that this was a purposeful suppression of the truth. Okay, now, how does he justify this chronological sleight of hand?
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with all of our other stations here. Well, this is Dr. Stan Jonathan, simply reading some of the Jewish historians who try to justify this sleight of hand of just changing history so that they could disprove Daniel's prophecies. Because Daniel's prophecies, you know, written certainly somewhere 550 B.C., somewhere in that area, basically give you the exact number of days between when they declare the emperor of Persia declares the temple of Jerusalem will be rebuilt and the coming of the Messiah. So basically, if that you accept that's true, then of course Jesus is the Messiah. You discredit that by rewriting history and taking out large segments of time. How then did they justify doing that?
It's very, very interesting. I'm going to quote Schwab right now, and this is what he says. If so, what might have been their compelling reason for so an unusual procedure as cutting out so many years of time? My answer is this. Nothing short of a divine command could have prompted saintly men of truth to leave out completely from our annals a period of over 160 years and to correct all data and to correct all historical tables in such a fashion that the subsequent chronological gap could escape being noticed by countless generations known to a few initiates only who were duty-bound to keep the secret to themselves. So now what's this man saying? A divine command to cover up and deceive the Jewish people about their own history and that of the world? Well, I think perhaps their own prophet Amos put his finger on the real problem. Amos 2:4, their lies have also led them astray, those after which their fathers walked. So what's the reason for this hoax? Well, you mentioned it, Dr. Stan. According to a number of Jewish scholars, including Schwab, but this their explanation is, God directed the second century sages to falsify the data so as to confuse anyone trying to use the prophecies of Daniel to predict the time of Messiah. Okay, now here we've got the issue. God gave the prophecy to Daniel so that everyone would know when to expect the Messiah, and then God tried to cover up what he had revealed so people would not know.
Well, I think that the important thing is to understand that there really are these two nominal gods. I mean, there's the God of the Bible, and then, of course, there's some people who look upon Lucifer as God. Certainly we do not, or if we refer to him in that way, it's with a small g. But we are really, of course, involved in a battle between good and evil. And there really are people today who worship the other God. And until you understand that, until you understand the Gnostic faith, nothing going on today makes sense. But if you read the writings of the Masons, you read them carefully, you'll find out that Masonry is a Gnostic faith. Rosicrucianism is a Gnostic faith. Theosophy is a Gnostic faith. And the Gnostics were, of course, there at this time in history, there in the first and second century. And they believed God was giving them direction. But I believe, of course, it was not the God of the Bible. Would you concur or disagree with that?
Totally. I agree with what you've just said. Absolutely.
You go right ahead, because, of course, you're much more of a scholar than I am. Remember, I'm simply a recycled orthopedist, but go right ahead.
Oh, Dr. The Lord gives us all a different work to do, and I would need to come to you for many things that would leave me frazzled, and the Lord's given those to you.
Amen.
But we all work together for his kingdom.
Amen to that. Well, you go right ahead.
Well, here we have. They ripped out more than 160 years of real time from Persian chronology and just threw it away. Now, what did they hope to achieve? There were two things they wanted to accomplish in this. The first was to derail the evidence which Christians had successfully argued since the resurrection of Christ that Daniel's 490-year prophecy was fulfilled by him. The second thing they wanted to achieve was to extend Daniel's 490 years into their own day. And by doing this, they could whip up support for a different messianic figure who might revolt against the Roman occupation. And this was achieved by a man called Bar Kochba and the revolt of 132 to 135. Now, If we ever need evidence that Daniel's messianic prophecy was understood by the Jews of the first and second centuries, we don't have to look any further than this cover-up in the Seder Alone book. And its abbreviated chronology firstly deflected attention away from Yeshua's fulfillment of Daniel 9, and secondly, it facilitated Rabbi Akiva's attempt to support Simon bar Kokhba as the fulfillment of the prophecy. And it was taught that bar Kokhba would overthrow Roman rule, then rebuild the temple. Now, what was the result of this misidentification of Messiahs? It was very, very tragic for the poor Jewish people. What happened was it led all to all Judea being laid waste by the Romans and by Jews being forbidden to live within 10 miles of Jerusalem. And as if that was not enough to add insult to injury, all Jews throughout the empire were required to pay a head tax to support a new pagan temple in, of all places, Jerusalem. And what astonishes me so much is that Jewish historians today still consider Bar Kokhba as their most important messianic figure, to quote them. Well, by the 16th century, some Jewish scholars were starting to challenge this Seder Alone book. There was a rabbi by the name of Rossi, and in his work, Enlightenment of the Eyes, he demonstrated that the year count was severely flawed. And although his conclusions were irrefutably correct, the revelation was hotly resisted by his fellow rabbis. And some of them tried to appeal to Rabbi Joseph Caro, who had written a famous book, urging him to ban Rabbi de Rossi's book. And Caro did actually impose an order to burn de Rossi's book, but he died before it could be implemented. And so the alteration to Persian Jewish history still remains in use. And yet, wherever you go in the world, no secular historian or no Persian or Christian scholars anywhere in the world accept the compressed version of history. They know that it's a fake, and many Jewish scholars are now also starting to dispute it. But when you discuss the Jewish state of the world, the source that's used is this very same book, the Seder Alone. In fact, that's the source where we get our counting of the year 2011. That's this year being the year 5771, year of the world. Now, when you compare the Hebrew Bible with the present Jewish calendar, now, using the Bible, we calculate back from the King Solomon's reign, and that's a date fixed in history. We arrive at a date for Adam, which disagrees with today's fabricated Jewish calendar. So what we've got here is a contradiction between their calendar and their Bible. And although the Seder Alone is not a formal part of the Mishnah or the Talmud, it is a work of Talmudic authority today, and no Orthodox Jew would think of openly contradicting it, despite the realization that it is missing so many years. And you know, you have referred to this a couple of times today already, Dr. Stan, that we're in a great battle here. It's a cosmic battle between the forces of Satan and those of Jesus Christ. And I feel here that this is such a big hoax. It's got the breath of something bigger than just an ordinary human hoax. It's no ordinary hoax. I can see behind it the intense antagonism of the Legion of Lucifer in his long-running feud against the Prince of God. This is just one of his tricks that he's used men to foist upon other trusting people.
I think we can't really understand anything going on today unless we understand this. I mean, because so many things going on today just don't make sense if you really stop and think about them. And yet, of course, most people never stop and think, and they simply go along with it. They watch television. They watch the evening news. They watch the latest television. It's in the competition, say, for the best voice or the best dancer or something else. But they see unfolding events, And they just can't make a simple conclusion that, of course, we're seeing this cosmic battle being played out. And a beautiful example of that is the coming war in the Middle East. It's only a matter of time before we're in a major war in the Middle East. And the average American really doesn't see what's going on because he's too busy watching television. Go right ahead.
Yeah, it's so very, very sad. I have a brother-in-law down on this side of the world who has thought of nothing but education all his life. He excluded all spiritual values and put importance in education. He has so many degrees, I don't know how many. And then last year, he had a very serious health setback. And only this week, he said to us, I'm not enjoying my work anymore now. All I'm interested in is getting right with God because I realize there's nothing else worth living for.
And
has shaken the man up, and I just wish that, not wishing signals on everybody, I'm just wishing that a sudden wake up would occur to millions of people who are slumbering right now and thinking that they're all right.
Well, that's, of course, our hope is that maybe something we say or something one of our guests says will strike somebody's heart. Unfortunately, it seems that we only reach one person at a time. The other side reaches millions. But our job is to do our best, and this is Neo. Of people, I think, as things get worse, you're going to be looking for answers. And when you lose your job and you lose your home and you lose your family and you lose your savings, maybe you're going to begin to, and maybe even part of your health, maybe you're going to realize that there's much more to life than simply living the good life. Maybe you're going to try to find what's important eternally. At least that's our hope and our prayer. We'll be back in just a moment with Jonathan Gray. Go right ahead, Jonathan.
Yes. Dr. Spann, it's very interesting that this whole attempted cover-up of Daniel chapter 9 just will not die. I was noticing a report in history in Poland some time ago. In 1656, a dispute arose in Poland between some distinguished Jewish rabbis and some Christian students of the Book of Daniel. And the dispute concerned Daniel chapter 9, Daniel's 70 weeks, 490-year messianic prophecy. The students faced the rabbis and said, look here, this prophecy proved Yeshua to be the Messiah. It tells exactly when the Messiah was to suffer. Well, the rabbis were so hard-pressed by this argument, it was embarrassing. So they broke up the discussion. But then the rabbis held a meeting. And as a result, they pronounced a curse upon any Jew who should attempt to work out the chronology found in this prophecy. And this is their curse. May his bones and his memory rot, who shall attempt to number the 70 weeks. I've come across a couple of curses. There's another one in the Talmud, which mentions that the curse is based upon the fact that there are claims that the Messiah is in this prophecy. Well, of course there are claims. Daniel himself claimed it. And it's quite a frank admission. Well, that will continue, but I do believe that any atheist or any unbeliever, any skeptic who honestly approaches prophecy, Bible prophecy, will find that there is only one answer to the knowledge of events ahead, and that's an all-seeing God who gave his son to come down and predicted the date when he was coming. Now, at the same time that the cover-up was going on in the land of Israel, another cover-up began in Alexandria in Egypt, not too far away. Now, approximately the same time that the rabbis were mutilating that calendar, Ptolemy actually was a man, it was believed that he was a Roman who spoke Greek, but he lived in Alexandria. Ptolemy's star chart is famous, and Ptolemy's world map. Now, Ptolemy cut out. Did we mention this on a previous broadcast, Dr. Stanley?
No, we didn't.
We haven't talked about the gospel and the stars on this.
No.
Okay. Ptolemy actually got hold of a star chart that had been in use for 4,000 years and which identified the Messiah by name. That's a subject worth looking into sometime. And he cut out that whole, cut out of the star chart and left a big blank on the star map where that constellation used to be. And that constellation was traced in recent years after Napoleon's soldiers went to Egypt and discovered the ancient star map painted onto the ceiling of a temple up the Nile Valley. And they recognized it and copied it, and it's in the Louvre at the moment in Paris. But this star chart actually not only revealed that there was a coming one, but the star, names of the stars, the names of the constellations spelled his name out just as it is in the Bible. And it seems that there was pressure in Alexandria to suppress Christian gospel there, and so it was cut out.
Okay, this is Dr. Stan. Jonathan was just saying that there was certainly efforts. Very early on, gentleman had actually taken a star chart and cut out part that had referred to Christ, and they reproduced the star chart, but they left out this one segment that really spoke and named Jesus coming. There's always been a conspiracy against God. I mean, we talk about it today, but it existed 2,000 years ago. It has always existed. I mean, certainly, why do you think they took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools? I mean, do you think that this just happened by accident? There was no wall of separation between church and state. There is a conspiracy against God. There was a conspiracy against God 2,000 years ago. There's a conspiracy against God today. It's a common denominator behind everything going on. But you go right ahead.
Yes, it's a long-running battle. But we know who's on the winning. We know who's going to win. Just to recap a little bit, we remember that the Creator promised to send a rescuer, but Satan and his group came up with a stand-in personator, and that was to blind people from accepting the real thing. And this counterfeit Christ system wore many masks, but it was summed up in the name paganism or pagan mystery. Now, eventually Jesus came. He broke into Satan's territory. And the hijacker of our planet, Satan himself, tried to overpower him, but Jesus beat him. He beat him in the wilderness when Satan offered to give him the kingdoms of the world. Just bow down to me and recognize that I've got this planet, and I'll give you all the kingdoms. And he failed to tempt him. And then we have Jesus living a blameless life, showing us how to successfully withstand Satan's tricks. And then he offered himself up as a sacrifice for everyone's wrong. Then, having fulfilled that purpose, he cracked the power of death and told his followers to go and let the world know what had happened. Wonderful message. Well, Satan's bid to sabotage Jesus Christ's entry into earth had failed. And, of course, he was furious. And so, immediately, there was planned an extermination campaign against Jesus' followers. It's interesting that the book of Revelation refers to this I think it's Revelation chapter 12, it says when he saw the woman's child had gone back to heaven, ascended to God and his throne, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man child. And in scripture, a woman is a symbol of a church. So the church, the bride of Christ was persecuted. And if someone wants to get at you and they can't reach you physically, what's the best way they can get at you? It's by attacking somebody that you love, isn't it?
Right.
And so an attack came upon the ones that Jesus loved, who were here on earth, who had accepted him. And there were two centers of the attack. One was in Alexandria, which was the center of pagan philosophy, and the other was the headquarters of the empire. The two attacks were launched primarily from these two centers, the headquarters of the empire being the city of Rome. Let's just look at the Alexandrian attack first. First they tried to exterminate the followers, They hunted them down, they tortured them, they murdered them, but the numbers continued to explode, and so they plotted a different approach, and that was to set up the Alexandrian cult, which had one purpose only, and that was to infiltrate the Christian group and to tamper with the Gospels and make them more compatible with paganism so that Christianity would have no power over the pagan religion. And the cult's allies in Rome were a great help too. Later on, an emperor would ascend the throne whose aims were similar, and his motive was more political, though, to amalgamate the two strong religions, Christianity and paganism, because Christianity was now growing very strong, and to keep the empire united. And but let's go back to Alexandria. The infiltrators included a man called Origen. Now, Origen looked at the Bible. He said, I'm going to change some of this to agree with my own teaching. Now, he pretended to be a Christian. He had been baptized into the Christian church. He had graduated from a Christian college. He now became a teacher in that college. And he thought he was a bit wiser than the Bible writers, and so he began chopping out passages of the Bible that didn't suit him.
Ah, is that where the Alexandrian text then of the Bible came from, huh?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, I've always wondered. Go right ahead.
And he allegorized other Bible events that he wanted not to be taken literally. And of course, this double-pronged approach of cutting out bits and allegorizing other bits suited both the pagan and the false Christian.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Yeah.
While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that's free. Let us all be grateful for a land so fair. As we raise our voices in a solemn prayer.
Well, you go right ahead. I think that is fascinating, you know, because, of course, there are a couple of Cambridge scholars many years later who then, of course, tried to incorporate the Alexandrian text into modern-day Christianity and use that to undermine it. It was like Hort, I forgot the two people, but they...
Yeah, Westcott and Hort.
Westcott and Hort, right. Go right ahead.
And that's a fascinating story too, Dr. Stan, if we have time for it.
I don't think we'll get to Westcott and Hort. That'll be something else for our listeners, because basically, of course, they wrote the standard dictionary used to translate Greek into English, and this is what all of our ministers use. They use Westcott and Hort's dictionary, and they've gotten for, you know, 100 years. All of the wrong information. Both of these people were deeply involved in the occult, and of course they had a profound impact on modern day Christianity. But you go right ahead. We're talking about the Alexandrian text of the Bible.
That's right, yes. Now, these guys in... what happened was that when the Christians fled from Jerusalem, many of them, well, actually, they'd all first of all gone to a little town called Pella on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and then they made their way up northward into Syria to a town called Antioch. And in Antioch, which is mentioned in the Bible, the Christians were first called Christians in Antioch. In Antioch, they set up a college to preserve and to copy as many copies of the scriptures as they could. And Antioch became a missionary center for the whole world. Now, from Antioch, missionaries were sent down to Egypt. And Alexandria, being a center of pagan philosophy, the Christian church worked very hard there to win people to the Lord. And they succeeded quite well. But, of course, the pagans were very upset by this. So after persecution failed, they said, well, the most successful thing will be to neutralize this Christian movement. So we've got to infiltrate it and pretend that we're joining it, and then when we get into positions of power, we will teach our beliefs, and that will mean the Christian religion will disappear.
That's hold that thought. Right. Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, because Jonathan was just saying that after the siege of Jerusalem, why many of the Christians, of course, were able to escape, and then, of course, they migrated north, suddenly up to Antioch, where they set up their missionary center and began sending their disciples out to spread the gospel. And, of course, some of them went to Alexandria, but the people in Alexandria, of course, wanted to destroy Christianity, and when they realized they couldn't destroy it, then they set out to infiltrate it and change the structure. And I think that's where the Alexandrian text came from, that today have replaced the traditional text of the Bible, at least in many of our major universities and seminaries. But go right ahead.
Yeah. Now, then, of course, we move across to Rome, the capital of the empire. Rome and Alexandria worked in very nicely together, because while Alexandria was the center of pagan philosophy, Rome was the center of the empire, and it was the center of pagan sun worship. And the two, of course, were one and the same religion. And in the city of Rome, of course, persecution became very intense also. And we remember about Nero blaming the Christians for the burning of Rome, and we've heard of the Christian catacombs. I've been down underground under the city of Rome, and I've walked through the catacombs where they lived and worshipped and buried their dead and hid away from persecution. And for a long time, persecution continued in Rome. Ultimately, Christianity was becoming so strong, however, because the blood of the martyrs only sowed seed, and many more Christians would spring up. When they saw that this is a powerful movement and nothing can stop it, it grew and it grew, and it threatened paganism. And if the message of Jesus Christ was true, then it meant that the pagan altars of Rome would disappear. And that could not be allowed to happen. And so once again, they followed the example of Alexandria and other places, and they said, all right, we've got to infiltrate. And we'll not only infiltrate here in Rome, but we'll infiltrate everywhere that we have our influence. But Rome became the center. And it wasn't too much longer before the church in Rome, persecution stopped. A Roman emperor declared that Christianity could be accepted as one of the religions of the empire. And that was a political ploy, because half the empire was now Christian and half the empire was pagan. And he, being a good politician, could not have such a divided empire. He wanted one religion only in the empire, and that would be an amalgamation of the two. So he looked around for a document that could unite both of them. And immediately he recognized the Alexandrian manuscript that had been fiddled by Origen, and said, this will suit my purpose. Here is a Bible that both Christians and pagans can be united upon. And so Constantine's friend Eusebius was asked to edit the Origen's Bible, and Constantine had 50 copies made. And this became the basis of the Bible that was eventually adopted by the church in Rome. Now, you mentioned the Alexandrian manuscripts. That's true. Now, we believe we know three of these. There are at least three surviving manuscripts of the 50 that Constantine had Eusebius make. One is called the Sinaiticus, and it's interesting that was found in a Catholic monastery down in Sinai. And the Vaticanus was found in the Vatican. And both these manuscripts had been lost for several hundred years, but at a very crucial time for church history, they were brought out as weapons against the true Bible manuscripts. There's evidence that these manuscripts are survivors of the type ordered by Constantine. Now, Constantine thought that was a good move, and for his political ploy it was, but there was one problem. There were too many wide-awake Christians scattered all over the empire, and outside the empire who couldn't help noticing that Origen's Bible, adopted by Constantine, this revised Bible, compared unfavorably with the original pure Bible that had been preserved. And there was now a battle of the Bible. Now, Rome occupied the strategic gateway to Asia at Constantinople, and these uncorrupted Bibles, along with the Greek and the Eastern literature, were sealed off. It was decided to seal off the East from the West so the people in the West could be given the corrupted Bibles and the church in the East could have no type of influence any longer. And as a result of this policy of censorship, most of Europe was plunged into the Dark Ages. And around 400 AD, Jerome gave the church in Rome another acceptably altered Bible of the same type, but it did not gain ready acceptance. Later on, it became known, however, as the Latin Vulgate. Well, let's just see who these chief corruption culprits were. First of all, there was Clemens of Alexandria, who just preceded Origen. He boasted he was a teacher in the Christian church in Alexandria. He was one of the infiltrators. He said, "I will not teach Christianity unless it's mixed in with pagan philosophy." Then came his pupil, Origen, who allegorized the Bible and cut out bits to suit himself to make it compatible with pagan philosophy. Then came Emperor Constantine, who commissioned the corrupted Bible to be used in Rome. And then came Jerome, who drew on this altered Bible as one of the sources for producing the Latin Vulgate for the church in Rome. So that was the history of that manuscript. Now, when we look at the Vaticanus corruption, these Alexandrian manuscripts have so many changes in them. It's absolutely amazing. I think it's a subject we could go into another time, but I just thought I'd mention that there are thousands of changes, not just a few dozen or a few hundred. There are several thousand changes in these. Incredible. And yet these manuscripts that were corrupted, and I've seen people on the internet and elsewhere making claims that you can't believe the New Testament because it's been changed. Constantine and his men changed it. Well, of course, they adopted a changed manuscript, but they had no influence outside their own territory. And as it happens, 99% of the old manuscripts we have today represent the pure, unchanged manuscript. The altered versions only represent 1%, so you can't say the Bible's been changed. 1% was mutilated. 1% of all the manuscripts were mutilated. 99% of all the manuscripts remained pure through history, and that's a wonderful story of preservation which I'd love to tell.
And that is that what they call the Textus Receptus?
Yes, that's right. The Textus Receptus, which means it's a traditional text, and which means, really, the text that has been received from the apostles.
Right.
And it's also the majority text.
Now, that is the basis of King James, then?
That's the basis of the King James Bible. The King James Bible is the most faithfully translated Bible that we have in the English language.
Yeah, is that better than the Calvin's translation?
Calvin actually is very, very close.
Okay.
There's not much difference. Calvin got his from the Textus Receptus as well. And it's a very good Bible. But I should say, the King James, there's nothing more accurate than it, but it's the most widely distributed, most accurate Bible in our language.
I guess they call that the Geneva Bible, but be that as it may, basically there is a difference between that. And then they have all these new translations that they keep coming up with in an effort to destroy our faith in the validity of the Scriptures. These people on the other side are so clever, they hate Christianity, and we'll find any reason to disbelieve it.
That's true.
You go right ahead here.
Okay. So what we have here now is a scripture that has been perverted, and the perversion only represents 1% of manuscripts. The rest of the manuscripts all over the world, now by the time of Constantine, which is about in the middle of the 4th century, There were so many thousands of manuscripts. Constantine could never get his hands on those and recall them and replace them with his corrupted manuscripts. And so the pure manuscripts remained in use all across the world, including in his own territory, by faithful people who had to go bush and hide in the mountains to preserve it, but they did. And we bear in mind the Vaudois people, the Waldenses, the Pyrenees Alps, and so on. A marvelous story. If anyone ever can get hold of that book, The History of the Waldenses by Dr. Wiley, it's well worth reading. It'll stiffen your backbone. Anyway, when we look at what was happening in Rome, though, we realize that today people mistake Rome for Christianity and Christianity for Rome. Whenever you think of a religion, you think of one big religion which is so well known and is the richest in the world. And a lot of people mistake that for what Christianity is. Now, there are many churches today which claim to be Christian, but that doesn't make them Christian any more than claiming that a tail of a sheep is a fifth leg. It's no more Christian except by name than what it will teach and how it will act. And so we can't judge Jesus Christ by what many Christian people profess today. We've got to go right back to the Bible, and we've got to live by it if we want to give a witness of what true Christianity is about.
And yet, of course, some Catholics already live by the Bible. In fact, one of the most amazing things was Pope John Paul XXIII and the dramatic changes he brought to Catholic Church. But one of the most important things he did was to give Catholics the ability to read the Scriptures. I mean, and that suddenly allowed them to get to the Bible and really find out what Christianity was about, not simply go to church and hear the sermons in Latin which they couldn't understand. So whatever reason Pope John Paul XXIII did what he did, whether he meant it for good or evil, I don't know, but certainly God used it for good.
Well, yes, and so my dear wife grew up in that religion, and she's the most wonderful woman in the world. So the fact is, God has His people everywhere, and when a system gets taken over by the enemy, you can't blame the ordinary people, and many of them are as good as all of us. We're talking here about a fierce battle, a fierce cosmic war that's going on, and the agencies which are being used in this war. Now, I mentioned the Waldenses. I spent quite a lot of time in Italy, and I've been in the Vatican. I've studied through the Vatican. I've been underground into some of the churches. I have gone through the valleys of the persecuted Waldenses who kept the light of flame alive for hundreds of years. As a matter of fact, the missionaries from Antioch first came across to Italy, and many of the dear Italian people became very strong Bible believers, and that's why they were persecuted. And a number of them, when the church in the capital city adopted paganism, they realized that they must get out, and so they fled up into the northern valleys between Italy and France, and there they kept the gospel light of flame right through the Dark Ages. Wonderful people. Thousands of them died and were burnt at the stake. Their Bibles were burnt when they were found, but they, despite that, they fought the good fight and they kept the fair faith. And that Bible, at the time of the Reformation, was still being used by them. And when the Reformation opened up access to the East, Church of the East outside the old Roman Empire territories, and they brought manuscripts from the East, Bible manuscripts that had been copied at Antioch and used in places as far away as India. When they compared the Eastern manuscripts with the Waldensian Western manuscripts hidden in those valleys of northern Italy, they found that they were virtually identical. And as you suggested, Dr. Stan, these became the basis of what we today call the King James Bible.
Okay, well, so that gives us the background, and then we've got maybe about 6 minutes more, so you go right ahead.
Okay. Now, one of the great champions of the Reformation, which was a return to the Bible, was because the Bible was burnt by the ruling church for hundreds of years. In fact, history shows, and unfortunately, these books are being borrowed out from libraries and never returned. And whether this is a deliberate plan, I don't know, but it's a pattern worldwide that the history books which reveal what went on in the Dark Ages are disappearing from our public libraries everywhere. When the Reformation struck, Martin Luther, one of the greatest champions of history, of God's Word, rose up in Germany, and his revelations were followed by those of Huss and Calvin and Wesley and others. It shook the established church to its knees, because the established church was suppressing the Bible and burning the Bible. And so there had to be a counterattack, and an organization was raised up. I don't know if I should mention its name, but it's a well-known name beginning with J. And this organization was raised up deliberately to destroy the Protestant Reformation. And one of the first things they did was to do what they had done in the city of Rome, in the city of Alexandria earlier, and that was to infiltrate the Lutheran seminaries and the Church of England seminaries, and infiltrate all the seminaries they could and become members of those churches, so that they could rise to positions of power and start attacking the Bible in the minds of the people. And so what we have arising in Germany became the first target. The target was to get rid of the Reformation. They had to destroy the Bible, because the Bible was the basis of the power behind the Reformation.
You know, I think it's so interesting today. We hear, well, my goodness, is this group of Methodist ministers, and they all say, well, we all believe it's important to be able to ordain homosexuals and women to be ministers in the Methodist Church or Lutheran. And you say, why would all these ministers, you know, be out advocating things which we know that God believes to be wrong? Well, it's because they have been infiltrated into the churches. They've gone through the seminaries. They certainly have entered the church. They've certainly lived the frugal life of a minister, so they could be there to undermine faith in Christianity today and confuse Christians. And we got an awful lot of confused Christians. But there is, ladies and gentlemen, a conspiracy against God. Certainly, my good friend Colonel Ron Ray had talked to this communist many years ago about their effort to undermine the fabric of our society. He asked him about the church, and David Horowitz, of course, born as a communist, grinned and said that was the easiest thing at all. It was easiest of all the things we had to do, easiest to infiltrate the churches and infiltrate the seminaries and change the music and the message of the Christian church. And boy, they did a good job of it. But this is a coordinated effort by those who hate God. We'll be right back in just a moment to wrap up tonight's program. Jonathan, we've got 3 minutes. You go right ahead.
Okay. Right. So Germany became the spearhead of the attack, because Germany was the home of the Reformation, first home. They had to get their revenge on Germany. And this is why from Protestant seminaries in Germany, there came out now new theories about the Bible. One was called textual criticism, the other was called modernism. They're both the same, really. And the teaching of modernism or textual criticism is this, that the Bible cannot be depended upon literally. It has errors in it, it contains contradictions, and that it's not historically true. Some of the events, like the Exodus of Moses and David, King Solomon, these people never existed. And this is now sweeping through many of the, right throughout the Protestant world. It started in Germany, and when Britain broke away and joined the Reformation, the infiltration began at Oxford University, which was training the pastors of the Church of England. And the Oxford movement began, and this is where Westcott and Hort came up. They were secretly worshippers of the Virgin Mary, and they were occultists who also had spiritualistic seances with the devil, and they secretly worked for 20 years with a committee to bring out a new Bible that would eventually get rid of the King James Bible. And that was known as the Revised Version of 1888. and that was based upon the corrupted manuscripts from Alexandria that Rome had adopted, and it was then followed with more manuscripts translated, the same manuscripts rather, translated into modern versions. And now today, of course, Rome supports the Bible. While it was previously burnt and attacked, now she's got her own versions out. She's very happy for that because it helps to water down the Protestant teaching and bring her own in. And Westcott and Hort's translation is the basis of all the modern versions based on the false manuscripts.
Well, of course, until we go back, of course, to the King James or the Geneva Bible, and that's why they are constantly under attack today. Our guest has been Jonathan Gray. It's been fascinating. I hope we could perhaps even continue this another time. I think there, I mean, certainly you have tied together so many of the loose ends, and I know very well that our listeners out across America are going to benefit from your teaching. I'm personally indebted to you myself. I've learned so much from listening to you and watching your DVDs. Thank you so much for being with us. Can we call on you again to continue this discussion?
Oh, certainly, Dr. Stan, and God bless you too.
And God bless. Bye-bye. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We hope you enjoyed Jonathan Gray. Remember, you can go to his website. Just go to your search engine, type in Jonathan Gray or BeforeUs.com. BeforeUs.com. Fascinating material. And, of course, basically, of course, there is a conspiracy against God, and Jonathan traces this from the ancient times. And certainly we'll try to make a before tape set on the previous 2 hours and this 2 hours, And then we hope we can get him on again, because you have to understand this conspiracy which exists today, that we will do anything at all to destroy the Christian foundation of our nation, the Christian foundation of Christianity. Well, this is the time when I need to remind our listeners that my ministry, Radio Liberty, is primarily listener-supported, and if you're out there across America listening to our discussion, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to continue doing what we're doing, you know, night after night, and certainly with almost 60 outlets, actually approaching 65 outlets every single week. We're reaching more people than ever before. But quite frankly, we need your help. If you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, if you agree that we are involved in a spiritual battle that's being fought on a political, ideological, cultural, financial, educational battlefield, then give us a call. 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Go to our website at radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com. Now, of course, we do have a great deal of information on so many of these subjects that we've talked about here. We certainly carry Jonathan's excellent book, going into the background, certainly, of what's going on today. We actually, of course, will be putting together a fourth CD set based upon the previous 2 hours of Jonathan and this 2 hours. If you want to understand how America financed Adolf Hitler, both before and during the Second World War, you want to get my DVD, The Best Enemies Money Could Buy, my interview with Professor Sutton, and then, of course, his book, Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, John Loftus's book, America's Nazi Secret, and Charles Higham, I was in the Trading with the Enemy. And you'll come to realize that it was actually both before and during World War II that American corporations, Americans, were building the weapons for Adolf Hitler, because he never could have done this on his own. He didn't have the money, but we were providing the money. We were providing the factories. We were providing the weapons that were used to kill American soldiers, just as today we are inciting a great war in the Middle East. And there's going to be a terrible war coming in the Middle East. In fact, Richard Perle at the latest Bilderberger meeting talked about the necessity of a great war in the Middle East, and this is the latest reports coming out. The people who were there at the Bilderberger meetings, and the Bilderbergers talked about the war we're going to have. So once you understand that, you begin making preparations for the very difficult times that lay ahead. Certainly the Russians are preparing for a nuclear war. The Swiss are preparing for a nuclear war. And in Sweden and in Singapore and South Korea, they're building their underground shelters. But we have no underground shelters here today for the people. They do for the elite. They have them on the West Coast in Denver. They have them on the East Coast, but not for the American people. You're going to have to start thinking about looking after yourself and your family. And, of course, we have a great deal of information on that from Joel Skousen in his strategic relocation, in his book on the secure home and the secure rooms. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. We hope you'll join the Radio Liberty family. You'll tell others. And then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, our provision and our protection.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.